first of all, welcome very much for joining us. I know you've got a busy schedule. We always appreciate somebody like yourself coming out to one of these calls and sharing your experience and your knowledge of homeopathy. For those of you who don't know, Grant Bentley is from Melbourne, Australia. He's been working and studying various natural therapies since 1987. Grant is a qualified homeopath and naturopath, and he studied clinical hypnosis and has a postgraduate diploma in Ericksonian psychotherapy. It's a very interesting form of hypnotherapy. Grant has served as a principal and senior lecturer at the Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy since 1995, and Grant devised a method known as homeopathic facial analysis, HFA, based on his experience in the homeopathic clinic, research using clinical cases and facial structure, and a contemporary interpretation of Hahnemann's three primary miasms. He's popularized his work for the general public through his Soul and Survival book, website, and online facial analysis tool. Grant has lectured in Australia, New Zealand, the Middle East, USA, and Europe, and I think now he's coming to Canada as well. He is in clinical practice in Melbourne, Australia, and provides consultations to patients worldwide using Skype. He's the author of Appearance and Circumstance, which was published in 2003, Homeopathic Facial Analysis, 2006, and Soul and Survival in 2008. For people, if they'd like more information on his research or books, that can be found online. And I guess, Grant, they can look for Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Just type in VCCH or Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy, and we'll come right up to the front there.
Okay, fantastic. And also, I believe for the general public, there's something called Soul and Survival, and also, I guess, also Soul and Survival for the HFA training for practitioners. Okay, so first of all, thank you so much for joining us. We know you're traveling a lot and doing a lot of teaching and a lot of work, so we always appreciate somebody like yourself taking the time out of their busy schedule and sharing their knowledge of homeopathy.
Well, that's my pleasure. It's not a problem at all. Glad to do it.
Great. So listen, the subject of the interview today is your method. So I'm curious, what is the origin? How did you actually come about developing this particular method in homeopathy?
Well, the whole method ended up, the method started in its development, I suppose, around about a decade or so ago. It was essentially that I was a senior lecturer at one of the colleges here in Melbourne, and I used to lecture a lot on the organon, and of course I was also in clinical practice, which is vital because that's where you gain all your experience and knowledge really from. The books are one thing, but to do it firsthand is really where most of your knowledge comes from, as it always is with anything you do with life. But what I found that I was doing was that I was teaching, I was thinking a lot about Hahnemann, and I had gone through the organon probably around about 10 or 11 times already with different students, and we got to that stage, and also too with chronic diseases, and we get to that stage where I'm talking about how Hahnemann is saying how the introduction of the chronic miasms into clinical case-taking, that knowledge of the miasms must be included when we are taking any sort of case for chronic disease, and it must form the basis of our prescription. And it just struck me one day that, in fact, I wasn't doing that at all. And what I was doing is that I was teaching that, and I was giving it lip service. But then what I would do straight after the classes is that I would go into my clinic and I'd do a number of chronic disease cases, and I wouldn't actually employ the miasms at all, not really. And so what I was doing was that I was taking the totality of symptoms and just really doing a repetitization based on that totality. And so whether or not like I said, I was really just giving the miasms a lip service. And so around about 10 years ago, I decided, well, I better really find out what Hahnemann means by this. So rather than just reading the chronic diseases and the sixth edition again, I tried to which kind of sounds strange for somebody who's read it so many times, but this time I really tried to understand it. And the basis is really is that the whole idea of just prescribing for chronic disease based on presenting signs and symptoms is not enough. I mean, after all, the Similimum was already effective in acute and epidemic diseases, and Hahnemann had applied that quite effectively, as we know, in his treatment of scarlet fever, in his treatment of war typhus. So he was well aware of what the Similimum would do. However, when it came to the treatment of chronic disease, Hahnemann found that just applying the Similimum via the totality of symptoms was not enough. And so the chronic diseases would keep relapsing over and over again. And so that, of course, as we all know, started his study into the chronic diseases, to which he comes up with the miasmatic theory, and that is that there is this underlying layer of disease, and that needs to be taken into account, and so be as well as the presentation of any chronic disease. So what we're doing is that we take in the signs and symptoms, or at least this is what Hahnemann is telling us to do, is to take in the presenting signs and symptoms via the totality, but to somehow include into that prescription an essence which is also going to deal with the underlying chronic prescription or the underlying chronic disease. And so as a result of that, when trying to find out, well, what does that actually mean? I was reading a number of other books, even though that they were on the curriculum, but again, this time trying to understand them at a deeper level rather than just read them out, was that authors like Allen and Roberts, for example, they were making consistent reference to facial features. And in Allen's book, as well as in Roberts' book, he talks about how, you know, the shape of the psoric forehead, or the shape of the psoric, the syphilitic forehead by comparison to the psoric, and so on. And so that had been the first time, really, I guess, that I was influenced by that sort of writing, because the trouble with what Hahnemann talks about, he says that in theory we need to include the chronic miasm into our prescription. The totality alone is not enough. Remember that he already knew about totality and symptomology, so he was getting good results already. What he wasn't doing was that if he applied that same model to chronic disease, he was not getting the same success. So he knew that there had to be something else to it, and that's the whole basis of the chronic disease theory. But like his friend Bonninghausen and a number of his contemporaries said, look, we agree with you, but the problem is that pathology is not a great indicator of what the miasm actually is. Like if you look at, even though sulfur, for example, is regarded as the prince of psoric medicines, when you look up ulceration or degeneration, then sulfur is a 3 there. So it's not, so what later we had a tendency to do was just say, oh, well, sulfur must be syphilitic as well as this, but we ended up with a system that was so confusing that if all medicines are all things and all people are all miasms, and you're kind of back to square one. So what I really wanted to do was, the one thing that had always struck me as lacking in homeopathy was its lack of objectivity. And so what I wanted to do was have some objective way of being able to understand either symptomology or the miasms. And when I was rereading Allen and Roberts, it struck me that, look, if the underlying miasm causes very distinctive facial structure, as what they're saying it does do, and that's not just homeopathic either, by the way. We know when you go back into, say, air branches of medicine, say 100 years ago, like clinical syphilology, well, what you have, which is a pretty odd name, but that's the way it is spelt, but pronounced. But what you have is that you could tell that the offspring of people who were infected with syphilis at the time of conception would pass on certain, quite recognizable traits of that disease. And, of course, we also see that with drugs like thalidomide and so on. So you can see the effects on facial structure or on body structure of particular drugs and diseases that have come before us. Now, if, as Alan and Roberts were suggesting, these facial structures or facial features are quite distinctive and unique to each one of the miasms, then my thought process was, well, if that's the case, then we could actually have a very useful objective tool by being able to read each facial feature and being able to catalogue it should give us the reverse, that we will be able to tell from facial features what miasm is dominant and therefore go back into what Hahnemann is trying to say in chronic diseases, that is, come up with some sort of method of being able to take the totality but know the underlying miasm and select a remedy that has both. And so really that was the philosophy behind how this all began. And so what I did from that point on was that I started using a whole range of successful clinical cases when it came to chronic disease. Remember that this is only applicable to chronic disease. We don't need it for acute. The similimum is enough. But when it came to the treatment of chronic disease, what I started doing was taking the photographs of everybody who had successful results of remedies that were already miasmatically classified. So, for example, sulfur or sarinum or, fuya or mercury and aurum. And so what I would do then is begin to compare what each one of these patients would have in common. Because what we're looking at when we're trying to identify a miasm, of course, we're not looking for idiosyncrasy in the sense of individuality. We are looking for the genus epidemicus of it, what it has in common. And so when I would get people who had a very good success with, say, Baraticarb, which is a well-known syphilitic remedy, mercury, which is a well-known syphilitic remedy, and, say, aurum, which is another one, What I was doing was taking people's pictures and then analysing their face to see what shapes and features they had in common. It's very important also to point out at this stage that this has got nothing to do with, say, like a Chinese art of face reading. There's nothing meant to be predictive or, futuristic about this. All that this is analyse, and it's also not about looks, by the way, either. It's about the shape and size and contour of different features because each one of the miasms influences facial features in its own unique way, and so therefore by collecting a bit of a dossier of what was going on, I could then take pictures in, this is, cutting a very, very long story short, we're skipping about 5 or 6 years here, but After about 5 or 6 years of collating information, I got to a stage where I was able to use it as a tool to be able to identify the miasm. So what I would do is take the case, take the patient's photographs, analyse it, be able to come up with what miasm is dominant, and then through the totality of symptoms, be able to select the medicine. And when in the end of my repertorization comes up, I only have to choose the medicines which are either syphilitic or psychotic or psoric, depending on whatever facial structure says my patients belong to. And so I just choose medicines from that group. So that's a very brief overview of a long history of how it developed and essentially where we're at now.
Oh, very interesting. So I guess the first question, just in terms of a little bit further elaboration, when you first of all, you use 3 miasms, is that correct?
Well, in fact, what we're looking at is that Hahnemann, what's really interesting about the organon is that it's applied to all of life, really. And what Hahnemann does is that he discovers how energy works, and he talks about this by laying down different laws in the organon. For example, and you've got to understand where he talks about this relationship of energy when he talks about different diseases. And the different diseases are essentially your miasms. So the miasms are the cause of all disease, and each one of them, as we know, like psora, pushes outwards, and psychosis encapsulates, and so, and then we've got syphilis, which goes inward. And so these are different forces, different energies, different diseases. And he talks about this when he says that two different diseases can't live in the same body at the same time. One will suppress the weaker, or if they are of equal strength, then they'll form to form a complex miasm, which is where we get the tubercular and the cancer from. So essentially what that means is that I believe that there are seven miasms in all, because Hahnemann talks about the three miasms. Even though he knows that there are a variety of other diseases, he still sticks with that three. I still think that that's correct too. I think Hahnemann's right in that. That's a long story as to why that's correct, but it's correct in a whole variety of different ways that life proves that correctness. But essentially what we do is that you have your three basic primary miasms, and then you can have the combination of all three of those. So you can have, because he says that the two dissimilar diseases of equal strength will combine, like you see in the sore and the syphilis making the tubercular, of equal strength you should be able to get a psychosore, a psychosyphilitic, and then also to the combination of all of them, which we later on call through Kent and Forbes, but we call it the cancer miasm. And so essentially, while there are three primaries, I think that there are seven possibilities of that. But so, yes, essentially seven is the ultimate number of that.
Okay, so then you would have seven miasms, and you would have remedies associated with each of those seven different possibilities, is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. What we've done is, just through clinical experimentation, is that we have allocated the majority of the polyquest to one of those seven groups, and so what that means is that when facial features tell us that a patient belongs to one of those particular groups, then what we do is we still repertize, because that's still an important process. And then a number of different medicines will come through at the end of that repertorization process. But all I need to do, and this is where it becomes that objectivity really pays off, is that I only have to select medicines that belong to the same group as what my patient does. And that's really where it becomes very Hahnemannian in that sense, because that's the whole basis of chronic diseases, is that chronic diseases is essentially that there is a miasm that is causing the problem, and that miasm will be a dominant miasm. And if we can select a medicine that is not that matches the patient in their symptom totality, but also suits the dominant miasm of the patient, which is also in the remedy, now we have the true similimum, is what Hahnemann is trying to say. And so this objective way that we have of being able to analyze facial structure leads us back into what I believe chronic diseases was always trying to do.
Very interesting. And how do the colors play into the whole method?
Well, look, the colors came into this essentially, it's a bit of a roundabout story, but essentially there are two reasons why I started bringing colors into this. The first one was that when I was dealing with patients, because I'm up until when you have start introducing an objective an analysis tool, then of course you're involving patients into the system. When I'm just simply taking symptoms, and before I even got into this at all, I would just take a guess at whatever I thought the dominant miasm might be that the patient is having. But this is all happening in an inner monologue of mine, so it's not being shared with patients at all. But the moment that I start taking pictures, of course, they want to know why I'm taking pictures, and so out comes the explanation of this, and so they want to know, of course, which is just human curiosity, is why, well, what group do I belong to? Now, of course, because they all have disease names, I mean, no one wants to go into a clinic just with a headache and come out thinking that they've got a predisposition for cancer, or they want to, you know, proudly show off their young child for me to turn around and say, well, I think it's syphilitic. So, you know, these biological sort of names were so negative because of their starting place that Hahnemann thought that they came from. Was so detrimental to the whole process. So what I decided to do was that to try and come up with some sort of name that was just benign and really didn't mean anything at all. So it didn't have anything positive, it didn't have anything, well, more importantly, didn't have anything negative or pathological to it. So originally and maybe it's because I had read Ortega or people of this nature, that we just decided that we were going to allocate colours to it, because essentially it was three primary colours, so three primary miasms. Let's just allocate the two. Although I do know that while I'd say that perhaps the idea came from Ortega, I found that my classification is quite different from his. He allocates them differently. But the way that I decided to do it was that the syphilis was cold, it's worse for the cold, worse at night, it's contracting, it's inward. So I decided to give that the blue. If I'm just going to do three primary colours to three primary miasms, I might as well try and match them up in at least their essence. So blue is very cooling and very inwards and contracting, so we decided to give the syphilis blue. And of course psychosis is all about inflammation and so on, so that's red, and then just by a process of elimination, Sora got yellow. So that's really where the colours come from. And also, too, because we deal with the combinations, the two dissimilar diseases of equal force combined, we decided to... Then what you got there, of course, was that tubercular, which would be a combination of the yellow and blue, became green, and so on. So that's really where the colours came from. Also, too, there was a second part to that, which didn't develop until later on, but we'll get onto this, I'm sure, but it really comes from a different definition of really now what the clinic has told me the miasms actually are. And so I'm kind of glad that I've broken away from those disease names, because it's I'm not sure how relevant they actually are anymore.
Well, that's perfect, because that's actually what I wanted to ask you about. I know that you've described the miasms actually as a survival instinct, and then you actually make a link to evolution. So can you explain what this is about? What is this link?
Well, it really started coming about just, again, look, there are two ways of viewing homeopathy. If you just take two of the most influential characters like Hahnemann and Kent. Kent always calls himself a Hahnemannian, and we think for a while that they're saying the same thing, but when you start analysing them, they're not. And one area where they are distinctly different is that Hahnemann says that it doesn't matter that what your mode of diet is, what your lifestyle's like, what your regimen is like, you cannot eradicate the miasm. Whereas what Kent is saying is that unless patients lead an orderly life and start including a better diet and an exercise regime into their lifestyle, then there's nothing much that a medicine can do. And so the two things are very parallel. So opposite, not parallel. But so what I was finding was that I would get quite a good result. If we just take a pathology, nothing too deep, but if we take a pathology like migraines, for example, I was able to treat a person's migraines. But then what would happen was that a few months later they would come back and saying that their migraines are beginning to return. And so what I would do is that it became obvious after a while, and I don't know really why it took so long for it to dawn on me, but what would happen was that every patient, regardless of their chronic disease, would always say the same two mitigating factors. I would say, when is your arthritis at its worst, or where's your migraines at its worst, where is your whatever at its worst? And the reply was always the same. It was always, look, it's much worse when I become stressed, or it's much worse when I become tired. And what I started seeing was that when patients would return, and it would be a good response, like their asthma would go and their migraines would be ameliorated, but then perhaps a few months later, it could be 1 month, it could be a year, it would just depend, they would come back and say they're just starting to return. And what I would do is that I would go into their, what was happening in their life. And most of the time, sure enough, what you would see is that there would be an energetic drain of some form. They were either working very hard or they had lost a lot of sleep, or what had happened was just that there was a death in the family, or there'd been an emotional breakup. And so what soon became quite obvious, and I don't know, this is what I mean, I don't really know why it took so long to become obvious, because we all experience it ourselves. When we become run down, these same old signs and symptoms that if we're prone to headaches or prone to mood swings or whatever it may be, when we get very tired or stressed, we're not at our best, and these old conditions start coming back again. And so what I began to conclude in my mind is that I think that this is not the reoccurrence or a reinfection of some miasmatic disease, but in fact really what it is that it is an energetic model. And so what we have is that we have all of our everybody is born with their own strengths and weaknesses. And so as a result of that, these weaker areas that normally require a surplus of energy, when we are tired or we're very stressed, they are not getting that extra bit of energy that they need. And so as a result of that, signs and symptoms develop. So I no longer see homeopathy in a medical model of, like, say, Hahnemann, nor do I see it in a very psychological model like I used to. I see it purely as a balance of energy, which of course it should be, because this is what our medicines are. Our medicines are an energy, and if it should work on an energy model, being an energy medicine. But I guess I'm a slow learner. It just took me a while for me to catch up on that. So what happened was that, excuse me, so I'm not saying in the slightest that Hahnemann or Kent or any of these other authors that talk about the miasms and the action of miasms in particular, like Roberts as one or Allen as another, talk about the very specific action of these diseases, like the pushing out of the sore or the encapsulating of the psychosis. I'm not saying these guys are wrong at all. But what I am questioning, and in my mind I've already made my mind up anyway, is that if what it came to was that if it isn't the disease that is pushing out to the circumference, then what is it? And so as a result of that, I concluded that the action that Hahnemann was seeing was right, that sore does push out. But what it is that, and I would see this too in the clinic, because I was, remember, I was equating facial structure to sore and being able to see this action in process. And it was true that yellow or florid people were prone very much more to allergies or to skin complaints or, you know, to this outward motion in general. But my conclusion ended up being that it isn't outward motion as a disease that is pushing out to the surface, but outward motion as a survival instinct, the way that we defend ourselves against disease. And that started making a little bit more sense, because when people became very stressed or tired, what would happen is that this instinct, well, survival instinct, would kick back in again. And so as a result of that, that would just follow that pre-programmed action of either outward motion or circular motion, that is imprisoning viruses or bacteria, so it wouldn't become systemic, or in the syphilitic sense, it wasn't really necessarily eroding so much, but it was conserving energy. And we saw this because what would happen was that many blue or syphilitic people under stress would lose their energy. They'd need to go to bed or they were very, if they got a cold or were infected with something, that even though they weren't throwing up vast amounts of symptoms, it was always this chronic tiredness that they would suffer from. And I began to realise this is a process. Like, if you look at this even with, if you look at stress, there's only so many ways that a stress response can exhibit itself. But if you take the cold, for example, which is how this is this whole kind of contracting energy, the way that life survives the cold, whether it's human beings, bears, or even trees, is that they become deciduous or they begin to hibernate. So it's this conserving of energy, and that was exactly what I was seeing in human beings as well. And so because I had reached the conclusion that this is not a disease so much, it had to be something else. And what I noticed that we do is that it's like when you go to cross the road and there's a car coming down the street and you fail to see it and it beeps its horn. What you do is you immediately jump out of the way. There's no conscious deliberation for this. And the reason this is a long, very long story process cut very short, but the conclusion that I've drawn is that nature has provided human beings, for all animals, that human beings, that when danger is evident and it's apparent and it's right on top of us, what happens is that this is not the time for conscious deliberation. And a new part of us, an instinctive reactive part, comes into play. And that's what I call this survival instinct. And so what happens is that consciousness is relegated to the background and just instinctive reaction takes over. And we see this begin to happen even in ourselves when we become very tired or stressed. So we become snappier or become more teary or we become a lot more self-centered when we're very tired or stressed, because what that is that's that energetic trigger. We have our body works, as you know, by a whole range of negative feedback systems, whether or not we're dealing with blood gases, sugars. The process is the same. And this is the thing, that the laws that govern one aspect are the laws that govern all aspects. So I just sort of made the leap that if this is happening throughout the body, perhaps there is a negative feedback system when it comes to energy. And so what patients were saying, of course, was that they were confirming that. Because if there was a negative feedback system related to energy as well as every other aspect of our body, what we should expect for patients to say is that when their energy levels become erratic or stressed, or they become tired or exhausted, then in fact that our body should be at its worst, like being hypoglycemic or hyperglycemic. This is when symptoms should show itself. And of course, that's exactly what they were saying. My arthritis is worse when I become very tired, or my migraines become worse when I'm very stressed, and so on. So that's what I mean about a survival instinct. It is our way of being able to, if we say saw outward motion, it's our way of pushing stress to the circumference so it does not affect the interior. And so that's what I mean by it's more a survival instinct than a disease itself.
Interesting. Grant, I'm curious, do you find that a lot of your patients have more than one of these miasms? And if so, how do you address that in your method?
No, I don't find that they're either going to have a complex miasm, which is an equal value, like the tubercular. The tubercular is not necessary. We don't view the tubercular miasm as just partly sore or partly syphilis. We see it as the combination of the two. And this is, I guess, where colours become perhaps a little bit more important. It's a little bit like if you look at just the periodic table itself, even though every element is just the same protons, neutrons and electrons, the addition of each, the multiplicity of each of these protons, neutrons and electrons forms a different element which bears no relationship to the other elements. So even though carbon shares the same basic energies and particles, carbon is not interchangeable for uranium, and uranium is not interchangeable for hydrogen. So once something by combination has changed its form, it is not it's not accurate to look at it as just a little bit of this and a little bit of that, although it's very tempting to do so. But I guess this is where colours also become important, because yes, it's true that yellow and blue make up green, but green is not the same as yellow, and green is not the same as blue. Green is green. It's a different colour with different qualities entirely, just the same way as uranium is different from carbon, carbon is different from hydrogen, but they all share the same protons, neutrons, and electrons, just a different accumulative amount, that's all. So once that accumulation takes place, it is an entirely different character. Because there are only the three primary miasms, and I believe Hahnemann is accurate in there, and one of the reasons that life bears that out is that we live in a... When we're looking at actions like forward, backward, and circular, there's only three ways that we can move in a three-dimensional universe. There might be other dimensions outside of... It's a little bit more esoteric, I guess, but there might be other dimensions outside of the material universe. But in the material universe, there's only one of three ways that matter can move. And this is what Hahnemann was seeing. It's just that he ascribed them to an infectious base, whereas I am ascribing it more to a survival instinct. And I guess this goes back to your other question, is where do I put evolution in this, or why do I even bring it up at all, I suppose. The point with it is that in the Hahnemannian model, which, as I said, I don't actually agree with. I agree with the notion that the observation of what he saw, but the conclusion of as to what caused it is what I think is up for debate in my mind, is that if when you look at the different authors, say, well, we'll stick to the same ones because they're in my mind, Kent, Allen, Roberts, so on, they all talk about the miasms as being completely destructive, and that they move from one generation to the other, becoming increasingly worse, increasingly more savage, and destroying us, so each generation becomes weaker than the one that preceded it. But the fact is that in reality, nature does not allow that to happen. Nature has either adapts and overcomes. If we look at human history with biology, whether it's the indigenous people out here with colds and flus in Australia, or the Hawaiians with measles, or the South Americans with smallpox, yes, because these people were not, they didn't have the immune system that was ready for this new impacting virus, they suffered incredible loss. But what happened was that their immune systems rallied, they adapted, and they evolved to make sure that they could cope with the next wave. And that's what survival is all about. If you can't adapt and evolve, then we just go the way of the dinosaurs. So, in fact, that is absolutely contrary to how evolution and life works. And it's really the whole idea that the miasms are eroding us and making each generation worse goes against history and what we can observe. So I actually think that is a little incorrect.
Interesting. Grant, you know, I'm curious. I know you mentioned repertorization a number of times, and I'm curious. You seem to place a strong emphasis on that. I'm curious why. And also, you mostly prescribe polyquests or combinations, small remedies, polyquests. How do you, in terms of your method, what are you primarily using?
I primarily use Polyquest. The reason that I primarily use Polyquest is because, you know, look, while I'm sitting here saying that there's a number of aspects that I don't agree with Hahnemann, that is one, that the miasms are they're based on an infectious devolving model, that we are progressively becoming more amoral, more destructive, more weaker, more deathly, I suppose. And that is just contrary to how evolution takes place. So there's no doubt that I am being oppositional to certain aspects of Hahnemann's miasmatic theory, but there's a lot of it that I still agree with. And in fact, I still call myself a bit of a Hahnemannian, even though the basic platform of what is occurring is different. But one of the areas where I really agree with Hahnemann is in the idea of the polychrist. They often say the homeopathic historians talk about how Hahnemann had a medical case of about 100 different remedies, most of which he used only about 50 to 70. And what's really interesting about that is that I find exactly the same. I think the more accurate a prescriber that you become, the less you need a range of remedies, which is kind of understandable, really. I mean, what aspect of homeopathy is about quantity, really, when you come down to it? It's always been about matching up similarity, and it's been about quality, not quantity. So the frenzy to try and increase our pharmacy is and into the quantity of medicines, I think is kind of missing the point a little bit. And the thing with the polychrists is that they really are, once you know how to use them, they really are a drug of many uses for many people. Hahnemann found that. He relied on it. It doesn't mean to say that you're not going to use any other medicine, but it's like everything else in life. It's that 80-20 rule. I use polychrist mainly for about 80% of my patients, and I find it particularly effective. There's going to be 20% which don't respond to it, and I have to do the normal search like everybody does. But where I think polychrist perhaps fell out of favour is that they didn't yield the success that they should have. And so as a result of that, what we've done is we've gone on to more specific remedies for people and their conditions. But the point, I guess, with it is when you're dealing with chronic disease is that up until the HFA model, we really had no objective way of being able to determine what the underlying miasm is. We only could take it through the totality of symptoms, which is, of course, right back to the very square one, which is what Hahnemann is telling us not to do in the first place, which is why he spent 12 years researching it. So you have to know what the miasm is. You have to match that up to the medicine, and each one of these polychrists has been matched to one of these miasms, so we can use the polychrist more effectively now. See, the polychrists were being used indiscriminately, just being based on the signs and symptoms. And so as a result of that, they were just as hit and miss as any other remedy. But now that we can apply it through this HFA model with an objective system, now we can make these polychrists far more accurate. And so once again, I think I wrote this in one of the books, I kind of got a new appreciation for what Hahnemann was trying to say. Hahnemann was absolutely over the moon about these medicines. He regarded these medicines in the highest possible esteem for how much they could do. And it wasn't until the HFA model that I began realizing what an accurate statement that was. And it is true. It's that 80% to 20% rule. The polychrist will do 80% of the job for 80% of people 80% of the time. That doesn't mean, of course, that we don't need other remedies, but they will do it. And they've become such a benchmark. They've proven themselves over and over again to be so reliable as Hahnemann and Bonninghausen and Farringdon and all these people said so in the first place. I have rediscovered that. So I'm very happy with them.
Grant, how many do you place under polychrist? How many remedies is that?
Well, we've got around about 70 odd remedies that have been allocated. We're trying to add more each day, but one of the it sounds odd, but one of the difficulties that we have with adding new medicines is that we've got to find patients that don't respond to anything previously, because the whole nature of my clinic is to to try and help patients that walk into it, not just to experiment to find new remedies. So I'm always going to use the tried and tested ones first. And what we're finding is that, as I said earlier, the vast majority of people are responding in a positive way. So we really don't have a great deal of need to go in search for new remedies. But when we do, we add them. But out of that 70 or so remedies that we use consistently, we're getting such good results. The process of adding new ones is a slow one.
Interesting. Grant, I know that you're using, I believe, primarily lower potencies. Can you talk a little bit about that, why that particular posology?
I use repeated doses of 6s and 30s, primarily 30s. That has been a fair bit of experimentation, but that followed along from a change in the philosophy. What I noticed was, and what we're doing is, again, it's really important that we grasp the fundamentals of what HFA is all about. HFA actually can't be compared, and it's a natural thing for people to do. A natural thing for people to do is to turn around and say, well, you know, in relation to Sankara, and in relation to Shelton, in relation to this, and the difficulty with this is that it's very difficult to relate it to anything else because its fundamental principles of what it is that it's trying to achieve is vastly different. For example, the whole idea of peeling off a layer of disease is non-existent in the HFA model. The HFA model is not a disease model. It's an energy model. It uses energy medicines to balance out either erratic or exhausted energy. So I guess the best way of understanding an energy model is to just bring it back into daily life. And one of the areas where we gain our energy is through food. And I suppose that I'm using medicines as a kind of a way, you know, a bit like food. Yes, it's true that we need to eat to also supply different proteins and vitamins and minerals and amino acids and so on. But it also gives us a life force. It gives us an energy that we need. And we know this because we'll be hungry or we'll be depleted. You go out there, you have an apple or have a piece of fruit, and you begin to become far more energized more quickly than it's taking to be able to process it and get the sugars out of it. So it's this intermingling with the life force with life force. And I guess what I'm saying is because the whole model is an energetic model, not a disease model, and it's not a psychological model, which is kind of interesting because I adopted the psychological model, as you read out in the profile. I've been quite heavily involved in psychotherapy and hypnosis and so on. So it was natural for me. I did it easily to go down into a more psychological model, that being that inside our unconscious, somewhere deep into our mind is a stress or a self-belief or a delusion that about how we see the world. And the rest of the symptoms are just this wrapping around this central core, this central delusion, this central self-belief. And so I adopted a model like that very wholeheartedly because it fitted in with where I came from. The problem for me was that I found that a great difficulty in applying that. And so what I decided to do was just listen to what my patients were telling me. And it really came down to a far more simple method than this. You see, one of the things that really put me off the psychological model was the idea that there always had to be a psychological origin to it. So what I found was that people can become stressed or exhausted, not always because there's a negative self-belief, but because they've worked too hard, or that a woman has had too many children in a short amount of time and now just finds herself completely drained, or we eat the wrong foods for whatever reason. It could be necessity for just a short period of time, but by the time we get to the end of it, we're drained. Or we've done too much exercise and start getting headaches. I found that there didn't always have to be a deluded self-view of ourselves for energy to change. And so as a result of that, I moved out of a psychological model and into an energetic model. And I see inside of us is just kind of like scales, like what we have with blood sugars, blood gases, everything else. There's this kind of negative feedback. There's a set of scales inside us that when our energy goes either above or below certain defined parameters, that our body will react in a negative way. And it's reacting in that negative way because it's driving us to go out there and rebalance ourselves. And so seeing it in that energetic model, I can also see that people are, I'm not needing to get into the unconscious with my remedies. What I'm needing to do is that I'm needing to replenish slowly but surely, just the same way as if we had a starving child just delivered into our hands that needed this nurturing. What we do is we just don't feed it up with enormous quantities of rich food. We've got to slowly but surely introduce good and wholesome nutritious food, but not to overload it quickly. It's like evolution itself. It adapts itself via the consistency of threat. It doesn't adapt itself to this one-off sort of threat in the hope, you know, in the thought that it may or may not happen again in the future. What it does do is that it adapts itself to the most consistent threat. So consistency is the way to go in all of this. It's the way to understand it. It's the way to understand the energetic model of what it is that we're doing. And it's the same when it comes to the remedies. And what I see it as is that I see that by delivering 30C of a medicine on a daily basis, this is a slow but sure increase of a person's vitality, which will eventually just balance itself out. Now, it took me a fair while to actually get involved in this because, like most other homeopaths, and remember, I was teaching conventional or contemporary homeopathy for nearly 15 years, and the HFA model was only in the last part of it. So it actually, I had already been teaching the single dose and wait for many, many years, and it's how I practice. So it took quite a leap for me to start introducing medicines on a daily basis. But but of course, they needed to be done. The daily basis was really sought after, and it was sought after by Hahnemann. How do we know this? We know this because Hahnemann came up with the LM potencies. You see, if the 30C, if the just the single dose and weight was really as successful in all the cases as the theory would let us believe, then there was no need whatsoever to introduce the LM potencies because the 30 single doses would have already been working effectively. You only need to replace a system with a better system. And it's better because the other one had some gross failings. And so we know that that must have occurred. So even though that Hahnemann says that the moment that you get a striking amelioration, any repetition of medicine will actually undo what has been done, all I can say is that is not what I have found. I have not found that to be the case. And maybe it's because I've got the HFA model, so I've got I take that miasm into account. And because I see it as an energy model, I see drained bodies coming into my clinic. I see bodies that have no energy. They're constantly tired. They're now the pathology and pain is beginning as well. They're becoming even more drained and exhausted. In front of me, I see depleted people. And so my job is, in my mind, is to just constantly replace this energy slowly but surely and build them back up. I was well aware of all of the warnings. I was well aware of all of the expectations that I could possibly undo this and make it worse. But I was prepared to give it at least a go, and I monitored it very, very carefully. And what I found is that that did not occur. And it does, like I said, it also struck me that, you know, this, if the 30C was real or the single dose was really doing such a fabulous job, then historically we would not have needed to come up with the LM potencies. And the other thing, too, is if you read a whole range of authors, in fact, we repeat doses consistently all the time, despite Hahnemann's warning. If you have a look at Ramakrishnan's plussing method, or you could go back in the past if you want, Dorothy Shepherd and her magic as a minimum dose, where she's giving sixes and thirties consistently, or even Tyler when she gives a 30 one day, a 200 the next, a 1M the day after that. Bonninghausen used to repeat his medicines 1 week after the next week, even though he was doing it 200, he was doing it in 200 of this 1 week, 200 of intercurrent medicine the next week, and then go back to the original medicine. So this increased frequency has actually been a practical phenomenon, even though our theory has told us not to do it. Everybody who even wrote the theory of telling us not to do it has done it. And so with great trepidation, I sort of crossed everything and hoped for the best, and I began it. And I really kept, as I said, a close eye on patients, looking for this great undoing that I was expecting, but it just simply didn't come.
Oh, that's great, Grant. Listen, we're basically almost out of time, but I do want to give people a little bit of an opportunity to ask some questions. Before I do that, however, is there anything you want to quickly share in terms of what you're doing now? I know you're coming to Canada soon to teach, so could you just share in terms of any upcoming seminars or any other work that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, look, I will be in I'll be in Toronto, and I'm sure somebody in my office here is going to quickly give me the date of when I'm going to be there. I'm kind of a little bit of a head in the cloud sort of person, and so I know I'm going to Toronto, but I'm not 100% sure when I am going. Now I do know I'm going to be there on June the 11th, 12th, and 13th. So this is all part of a seminar tour that I was invited to do, and I've never been to Canada before, so I'm really looking forward to going. Also in Philadelphia, I'm going to be in Philadelphia on the 19th and the 20th. But for those that can't make it to those dates, we also run online classes that have been very successful. We only did the one. We've only decided, this year that we thought, oh, well, look, I'll see if anyone's interested. And all of a sudden we've got 70-plus students all online and doing this, and the feedback's been really good. So there's also that opportunity as well. But like I said, if you want to come and see what it's all about, if it's in Toronto, it's on the 11th, 12th, and 13th of June. And in America, it's in Philadelphia on the 19th and 20th.
Yeah, actually, I have some more information here for people. If you're interested in seeing Grant in Toronto, again, that'll be June 11th, 12th, and 13th. The phone number to call is 416-778-0085. There's also a website, www.grantbentley.yolasite. That's YOLASITE.com. And also, Grant will be in Philadelphia June 19th and 20th, as he mentioned earlier. You can call the BIHUSA. That phone number is 609-927-5660. There's also a toll-free number, 800-498-6323. That's 800-498-6323. And I don't know if this is possible for anybody, but I see you'll be in Dubai May 22nd and 23rd, Moscow May 29th and May 30th, and London June 5th, 6th, and 7th. So, Grant, first of all, thank you so much for sharing about your approach to homeopathy, the method that you've developed, and how you apply it in clinical practice. I think it was very interesting. I'm going to unmute the lines, and we'll just have time for just a few quick questions and answers. But let's go ahead and do that.
I'll go straight onto that, and thank you. But also, too, if I can just add the two websites, if anybody's really interested in having a look, is the all the W's, and it's VCCH, VictorCharlieCharlieHarry.org, or it's soulandsurvival, which is all one word, .com.
Great, thanks.
And .org if they're for homeopathic students. soulandsurvival.com, soulandsurvival.org. Okay, sorry, I'll take it.
No problem. No, I appreciate you doing that. Hold on a second. I'm going to unmute the line. Any questions for Grant Bentley?
Grant, what do you have to say about 200 potencies?
Well, the 200 potency, I was, of course, one of the most common potencies that I used to use. In fact, the 200s and the 1Ms in most of the time in the past were my starting potencies. But what I found is that just by increasing my accuracy with through the HFA model and the continuous doses of the 30s, I find that I rarely have to go up anymore. I think I was saying on the online class last night that I haven't used a 10M in about 5 years. I haven't used a 1M in years. I still do use the occasional 200s, but only once the 30 has run out. But luckily, it doesn't run out all that often. I don't have any problem with the 200s. I just think that with an energy model, that a continuous dose rather than a single dose is better.
Great. Other questions? I think perhaps we just have time for one more question for Grant Bentley.
How often do you give the dose? Every day, or how often? What are the intervals between each dose?
And also, can I add, do you add it in dry or liquid?
I usually do it in liquid, unless because the liquid is in ethanol, the only time I don't do a liquid is usually with children, or if anybody has obviously been addicted to alcohol, or perhaps if they're Islamic and they've got a thing against alcohol. So I use the pills there. But usually I use liquids, and I just put a couple of drops into a half a glass of water, get them to stir it and drink it daily. In reference to the frequency, what I used to do right at the beginning was that I got people to take it every day, and I would check in. I would get them to check in with me because I was very worried about a whole lot of good work being undone or aggravations and all sorts of things. But as I grew in confidence that that wasn't occurring, providing I got the medicine right, we aggravate on the wrong medicine more than we ever aggravate on the right medicine. So everything is about trying to get the medicine accurate and right. But I'm quite confident in giving it on a daily dose. So my standard prescription now, if somebody came in and needed sulfur, for example, then my most routine prescription would be sulfur 30 in liquids put into a glass of water or half a glass of water and to stir and drink that daily.
Okay, great. All right, Ken. Family, first of all, I'd like to thank you, and we give him a big North American and around the world thank you.
Thank you, Grant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Grant.
Okay, my pleasure, and nice to hear all your voices.
All right, thank you very much. Hope to have you back again.